You ready to roll? Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order. Please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We do have a quorum. We have all five of our directors here. As you notice, the board is over here on this side, and they will be listening and learning right along with us. All right. Oh, wrong way. Okay. All right, very good. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to our town hall on the Cambria Water System. I would first like to thank the staff for doing a tremendous job, especially these three people over here, Pavel Ogren, Melissa, and Jim, doing a great job on this presentation that you're going to see today. We're videotaping it so that if you have friends or neighbors that were unable to make it today, just let them know. This will be out on the website available through the AGP link forever, I guess, right? We keep those things forever. I'd also like to thank Karen Dean for baking about 300 cookies. If you haven't had a cookie yet, okay, they're over here on the left over by the coffee. Thank you, Karen. Great job. Great job. All right. The purpose of the meeting today is to provide you with the information on our water system and how the emergency water system / sustainable water facility interfaces to our water system. Okay. It's a fact-giving session that we're going to have here today. We're going to tell you what it does and what it doesn't do. We're going to try to explain how it operates, when it operates, okay, and what it does when it does operate, okay? So you have a very good feeling as to how the water gets from the wells and the creeks to your faucet, okay? We recognize that this is a rather emotional issue for the community, and so we are going to have future forums where we will talk and debate more the issues with the sustainable water facility, emergency water facility, okay, and we will allow you then to vent your opinions and give us your input on what you think we should do with the project description going on. But that is not the purpose of the meeting today. The purpose of the meeting today is really just to give you information and set a baseline as to where we're going with the project description, because the project description obviously is mostly what does it do today and how we're going to go from there. We will have some public comment today, but we're going to limit that to 1 minute because we feel that we're going to be pressed for time with the presentation we have, and commentary that you bring has to be focused just on the agenda today. So it's going to be comment that you might have on what we're going to present. So we'll have that first, and then we'll get into the rest of the – can I get the next slide, please? The rest of the agenda. We're going to do the historical timeline, give you an idea. There's posters out in the lobby that you may have seen as you were coming in. Planning and engineering that went into the emergency water system. Then a real broad overview of the Cambria water system and how it works and where it is. Next steps in the CDP process. Then we'll have questions and answers. We're going to do questions and answers on cards. So if you would like to ask a question at any time, okay, we have cards out in the lobby, and if you raise your hand, Monique will bring a slip of paper and a pen to you, and you can fill that out and pass it over. Vice President Farmer and Director Rice will be collating those so that we can get through the questions rather easily. We will try to answer everybody's questions. If we can't answer your question, we will research it and post it out on the website and answer on the website. Okay, we're not going to try to answer questions that we really don't know the answer to and give us our opinion. Today is not the opinion day. Today is just trying to talk about the facts. All right. At the end, we will have some concluding remarks by the board, and we may take some actions as to what we're going to do next as far as the next forums and that kind of thing. So, again, we'll move along now to public comment, and I do have three slips here so far. If anybody else wants to make public comment, you need to fill out one of these slips and turn it in. The people who are making public comment, we're going to ask them to come up here and speak from here, and the timer will be over here 1 minute, and the lights will light. Okay? The first person up will be Nick Lyons, followed by Jim Webb.
So my comment is I support this facility. I have a long history with Cambria, although I've only lived here full-time since 2012. Built our house here in 2008. I used to live in the Bay Area, but my father was born here. My grandfather and grandmother had a store on Main Street in the early 20th century. My grandmother was born up in the hills in here, so I have long history here. I used to come down here in the 1950s for Christmas at my grandparents' house. I've been aware of the long history of the water situation here in Cambria, and I've sort of tracked it. I was very pleased when this was built because it seemed like we were really making progress, and I just hope that we can push forward and get the permits that we need to get to get this finished so that we have water security here in Cambria. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Webb, followed by Dick Morse.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Jim Webb. I've been a resident, pardon me, in Cambria for the last 32 years, and my comments are to express concern over the ecosystem health of San Simeon Lagoon and Creek, which I have seen decline in the period that I've lived here. Specifically, I'm concerned about a project that pumps 400 gallons per minute out of a well, 9P7, which is the closest CCSD well to the lagoon complex at San Simeon Creek, while at the same time trying to mitigate the impacts of that pumpage by putting 100 gallons per minute back in to the creek. So if you have a bank account that is charged $400 a month and your savings go into it as $100 a month, you're going to have a deficit. And what's going to pay for the deficit is the degree of water that remains in the lagoon. And the steelhead and the turtles and the frogs and everything else that relies on that water is going to pay the price, not you. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Morris, please.
I'm Dick Morse. I've been a Cambria resident for 20-some years. You've heard this before, especially the board, but the anxiety, the fear, the emotion, the passion, all of these things that have been with us as a community for all these years concerning water, growth, the SWF, the millions of dollars that have been spent on studies concerning it, this forum, as Dave said, it's a very emotional issue. Why don't we let democracy work? Why can we not consider a referendum for this community and vote? What do the citizens want? We've heard what they want, but why not let them commit in a vote? And why don't we let the results of that vote govern what our future steps are instead of the arguments and all of the enemies that have been perpetrated as a result of wondering and assuming but never coming to grips with it. So I'm suggesting a referendum. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our public comment, and we will now get into our actual presentation. I'd like to introduce Pablo Ogren.
Thank you, President Pearson. Is this mic working? Okay, good. And Melissa Bland is going to be joining me for part one of the presentation today. Essentially, we have two parts to our presentation. Melissa's been doing a lot of the research, and she's going to introduce herself in a second. And then Jim is going to cover the second part. Jim is the chief plant operator for the water system and for the facilities. But one of our objectives is to really have a dialogue up here rather than having somebody doing a 30-minute presentation. It gives us the opportunity to interject questions with each other as we're going along and hopefully cover the points that we wanted to cover. As President Pearson had mentioned, though, today isn't a final type of a town hall meeting in order to then proceed to the board of directors with some specific recommendations to do something or another on whatever it is that we're working on. Today really reflects the first interaction that we want to have with the community regarding just what we've been doing so far over the last several months and the research that we've been doing. None of us were involved in the development of the project. None of us were really involved in the history associated with the district and the timeline and everything. And so in order to move forward with the coastal development permit, which is really one aspect of many things that needs to be done, we've been doing a lot of reading. There's been R&I committee meetings, resource and infrastructure committee meetings of the district. I know a lot of you have been showing up to those meetings. But we wanted to make sure to cover the material that we've been covering. And part of the purpose of the Q&A then is really a little bit of fact-checking or getting feedback from individuals who have been really following the details over the years, because there is a huge volume of information that's in front of us. And that information contains issues that are contentious, and it includes a whole lot of other information, too, that are still important, but maybe aren't, having the debate or the divisiveness in the community that some of the other issues have. So proceeding with to the board of directors with ultimately, down the road, recommendations regarding a project description so that the project can move forward to the county and start going through the coastal development process. And those steps I'll cover at the very end. But the dialogue with the community and working through those different issues is what's really going to be important, because at the end of the day, whatever the decisions are of the board of directors and whatever the ultimate decisions of are the Coastal Commission are going to have the probability of pleasing some people to a certain extent and displeasing people to a certain extent on other issues because of all those details and, the history and the emotions and everything. And as I heard an individual speak at public comment here, about the anxiety associated with these types of issues in any community, really. Having that dialogue and really working through the discussions on what the various details are ends up being important, because more and more, a lot of us, I know myself, that even if a decision isn't made necessarily the way that I would like it ultimately made, when I see that it's gone through good public discourse, that I feel like it's been discussed fairly and all the issues are on the table, then if something isn't, you know, exactly what I want, at least I feel like it's gone through a good public process, that the decision makers here locally, as well as the county and the Coastal Commission, have all vetted the issues objectively. And at the end of the day, everything in terms of being looked at is balanced appropriately and the best decisions possible are made. And that's really part of our goal. And as we're picking up these efforts and starting to learn about the history and the timeline and, you know, Jim's operating the plant and how it's actually working and everything, having the dialogue with the community up front is just really, really important in order to make sure we get started good, and as well to make sure we understand the issues that are in everybody's mind. So Melissa's, well, that's me. Who are you?
Hello, everyone. I'm used to being behind a desk, so I'm not a very good public speaker. I'm going to preface that. Melissa Bland, Management Analyst for the CCSD. I started my career here in January 2018 as the Engineering Assistant and the Permit and Compliance Specialist for the SWF. Since then, my role has morphed a little bit. I've taken on some additional capital planning work, project management, budget stuff. I do a little bit of everything, water, wastewater. They need my help, I'm there for them. So I've been reading everything from as far back as 1976, and I'm going to attempt to cram three decades of information into two slides, so please bear with me.
And I noticed, Melissa, that you're starting in 1990. I'm curious, by a show of hands, how many individuals in the room lived in Cambria in 1990? Okay, so some. Not a majority, though, definitely not. The thing that strikes me about starting the timeline in 1990 is that I was working on water resources in the county at that time, and that was, you know, we're in the middle of the prior biggest drought ever in the history of California. Sometimes when I look at the statistics, I wonder if these biggest droughts are really the biggest or not, but they're significant. And so this drought that we had in the late 1980s and in early 1990 really prompted communities throughout San Luis Obispo County to work on a lot of different water resource efforts. Communities in San Luis Obispo County were hit much harder than many throughout the state, and subsequently we saw the city of Paso and San Luis, the county, Templeton, Atascadero, come together and develop the Nacimiento Water Project. Through all the controversies of the State Water Project, that was also developed in the early 1990s. People in South County realized they needed to rebuild Lopez Dam in order to make sure that it could continue to operate for its future. A number of different, you know, really significant projects throughout the throughout the county happened. And it's then, you know, the timeline for Cambria starting with 1990 is just simply right there in line with all the other counties, communities in the region.
Right. So in response to that drought and partially in response to the county's decision to reduce Cambria's growth rate from the normal 2.3% for unincorporated areas of the county down to 1%, the district decided to close the residential wait list. And that is also the same year that the district begins to look into alternative water sources such as desalination and groundwater reinjection. So that 1990 mark is the beginning of several decades of studies and reports on those water sources.
And I know the questions I'm like prompting Melissa on, a lot of you already know, but still it's important. You mentioned 0% growth, but who did that? It wasn't the district.
No, so that was San Luis Obispo County's growth management ordinance. And in 1990, we were dropped to 1%, not 0% yet.
Okay. And of course, for Cambria, what's interesting is an unincorporated community, the jurisdictions are really divided, where the CCSD has jurisdiction over the water supply, the county, and make sure to introduce Supervisor Bruce Gibson's here today. Thanks for showing up, Bruce. Has jurisdiction over land use planning. And that is, of course, something that requires extra effort in terms of trying to make sure those are all coordinated. And as we go through the CDP process, we know that the growth implications of whatever project description might come forward to the board are going to be evaluated, even though the board doesn't have the actual land use growth or the land use jurisdiction itself.
So moving along to the year 2000, the district releases the baseline water supply analysis. This is a Kennedy Jenks report. Kennedy Jenks was looking at everything from recycled water to desal to groundwater recharge all throughout the 90s, and they came out with this report in the year 2000. It essentially tells us for the first time that using 2000 consumption rates and, you know, the kind of gallons per capita daily that was being consumed at that point, the district water supplies were determined to be marginal to inadequate to provide a 90% level of reliability to existing consumers.
And that 90% reliability means what?
Essentially, that means that the district's water supplies can support the existing consumers. But one out of approximately every 10 years, the district would be required to have consumers cut back. So that's where the Stage 2 and Stage 3 drought emergencies would come into play, and that mandatory conservation would kick in. So it's kind of like saying we have enough water except for during these years, but all that is required at that point in time is to respond accordingly with the mandatory conservation.
But one out of 10 years doesn't sound bad to me.
Right. It kind of depends on the type of drought you're facing. So if that's one out of every 10 years and you've got one dry year, that's simple. But when you have multiple dry seasons, that's when...
So it's kind of like that flip of the coin where you can actually get heads multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get those one out of 10 years
complicated
right after each other.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So that study is also what develops the emergency water conservation program that we still follow to this day with the Stage 1, 2, and 3 drought restrictions.
And part of the issue about bringing up 2000 and the Kennedy Jenks and the reliability analysis there is that it is a little bit hard to, you know, get your hands around, well, what does that mean, a 90% reliability, when we know we can have these multiple droughts? The other thing that we know about 2000 is since 2000, water demand has changed. Cambria and everywhere. If we look back to 1990 and how much everybody was using water then versus 2000 versus today, you know, water demand per capita has changed. And so as we move forward and look at this information and go through the CDP process, we'll have to revisit again how has water demand changed and what does that mean in terms of the change in reliability factors.
So the year 2000 is also when the county's GMO reduces Cambria's water or growth down further to 0%. So that leads us to November 2001, when the board takes action to declare the Water Code Section 350 water shortage emergency and decides to cease issuance of any further intent to serve letters, with the exception of what are known as pipeline projects, which were projects that were in process at the county and CCSD level to build. And then there was an exemption for affordable housing projects and then grandfathered meters, which were meters that are already in the ground but just hadn't been built on yet. Since 2001, the district has permitted 67 such new connections.
67 since?
Since 2001.
So I did math. I started Cal Poly as a math major. And so 67 and about 4,000 connections means 1.675% or about 0.1% per year. So that's bigger than zero.
Right.
You said zero.
Right. With those exceptions.
Okay.
Yes.
So those are all part of the exceptions.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. So moving forward a couple years, we're into 2006. At the recommendation of the California Coastal Commission and kind of in line with the North Coast Area Plan, the district puts together a Citizens Finance Committee to come up with a build-out reduction plan. Essentially what that does is it sets the residential build-out to 4,650 existing and new connections. So that sort of factors in our existing connections plus the, I think at the time, 666 or so waitlist positions, whatever remaining pipeline projects there were, and then a little bit for affordable housing and some unallocated connections. The plan provides multiple pathways to further reduce build-out via lot acquisition at fair market value, lot mergers, and lot retirement. And then the build-out reduction plan eventually gets incorporated into the 2008 Water Master Plan as a mitigation measure to account for the growth-inducing effects in Cambria.
And up there, you say it was subsequently revised.
Yes, I do. In 2016, the plan was reissued and brought to the board again. And those details are kind of going to need to be incorporated as we move forward in the regular CDP process.
Yeah, and you know, as David mentioned and Art already mentioned, the idea of the project description. The project description in the SEIR is a chapter in and of itself. And one of the important points in the objectives that is listed was this 4,650. Ties back to the building reduction plan. How does that all work in terms of what we're going to be addressing in the future? Those are some of those questions that we don't have answers to today, but we realize that the BRP and how it works into project objectives and ultimately what the board of directors is going to have to make some decisions on, that it's going to be a very important part of upcoming discussions.
So in 2008, the district releases the Water Master Plan. This is a result of a series of phase studies and reports. It focuses mainly on three items. So you've got desalination to augment the district's potable water supply, a recycled water program that is meant for more of the irrigation and using non-potable water for that, and then water demand management through conservation, retrofits, offsets, things like that. In 2010, the district enters into an agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers. They begin working on a, let's see if I can get this without stumbling on it, geotechnical hydrogeological investigation of a desalination project off of Shamel Park. There were multiple desal sites that had been studied over the previous 18 years or so, but ultimately that location is chosen as the one to move forward with and do essentially a feasibility study. In 2011, we hit a bit of a snag with the California Coastal Commission. Essentially, the Army Corps of Engineers acts as lead agency on that project and then issues a consistency determination that they're, that the investigation is in line with all of the regulations and protections for the environment in that area. And So the district hits a snag. I wasn't there at the time. I was in college.
I think the point there is that at that point in time, those alternative analysis and then the Army Corps of Engineers investigations start moving off the desk and into the field where they're they want to take borings of soil borings, and I guess I'd taken
some. Right, samplings, yes.
That maybe weren't as protected as they should have been or something
right.
like that.
Right, there was definitely, so this was, again, this was the Army Corps' work. The district wasn't involved heavily with this project, but the end result of this is there's an objection from the Coastal Commission, and the project is not allowed to proceed. So at about 2012 is when the focus from desalination shifts to looking at what those other alternatives that had been studied were. There was a previous study somewhere along this timeline that identified multiple options, but in 2013, the Army Corps of Engineers continues their work with the district, but focuses on coming up with a more fleshed out study of 28 different alternative water supplies for the community of Cambria.
And so as the Army Corps is doing their work, they encountered some challenges with the physical work they were going to do, but that didn't technically take desal off the options, though, because their final options were, desal, doing something with Morro Bay?
That's one of my slides coming up.
Okay, skipping. I'm jumping ahead.
You're jumping ahead. It is
the teaser.
San Simeon Creek Brackish Road, or Brackish San Simeon Creek Road Brackish Water Project, Whale Rock Reservoir, Shamel Park Seawater, which is desal, and then Morro Bay Shared Seawater Reverse Osmosis, which is still basically desal. So yes, we look at the district looks at 28 different projects, narrows it down to four that get fleshed out and studied further. One of those is that San Simeon Creek Road Brackish Water Project, which essentially is what the EWS turns into. So 2013 sees us in the sees the state of California in the one of the driest years since 1895. If you look at, there's what we lovingly refer to as a spaghetti chart on our website. It shows all of the well levels since 1988. 2013, that's a much cleaner version. 2013 would follow along that red line being one of the lower, the lowest that our well levels have hit. Interestingly enough, though, it is not the worst year on record if you're looking at our well years or well levels. That was actually 1989.
So the blue line is 2013 then.
There you go.
Right, and the bottom is the lowest that the well, and these are San Simeon Creek wells.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it looks like maybe June in 2013 was the lowest June reading historically. So that's 2013. Maybe we can go back to the timeline, Jim. And,
so,
oh, wait, you know, so now we've moved from 1990 to 2013. How many in the room were living in Cambria in 2013?
Uh-huh.
All right, so everybody almost between, if you weren't here in 1990, you were pretty much here by 2013.
Okay, so 2013 sees our well levels drop drastically. There are certain triggers if you look into the details of our permits and licenses where events will cause the district to have to cease pumping operations at our well fields. One of those was actually met in 2013 at the Santa Rosa Aquifer. We brought well levels down to that 3-foot minimum at the Windsor Bridge monitoring wells. We got a temporary exemption for that year, and we're allowed to continue pumping, but it was dire.
So let's stop a little bit just to explain this. So Cambria's water supply, you know, basically comes out of the two creeks, and Jim and I are going to cover some more of the details. And a lot of people refer to the numbers in the water rights permits or the license that is currently in hand or mm-hmm. is currently in hand. And we look at total numbers that we can pump every year, and during the dry season it's reduced. But what Melissa's also talking about is that Jim, and as part of Melissa's compliance work, actually has to monitor what's going on in the creeks, because then there's criteria, and those are the conditions associated with permits that says, look, if well levels drop in Santa Rosa, the number that you're allowed to pump doesn't matter anymore. You just got to stop pumping. Mm-hmm. And so that's what she's describing, and in, 2013, we were hitting some of those numbers pretty hard?
Yes. So those events
I
were taking
we,
place.
I said the district, the community.
You weren't there either. So 2013 is essentially that year that we talked about in that study where it's saying, you know, at some point in time you're going to hit this and you're going to have to respond accordingly. So that is a complicated year for us. It puts us into the state of California enters a state of emergency because of the extreme drought. And the governor issues executive orders encouraging projects that address drought and waive certain environmental review processes that can make these projects get through in a faster timeline. So the CCSD board declares the stage 3 drought emergency and authorizes work on the emergency water supply project. So that occurs early 2014. By the summer of 2014, we were beginning the permitting process for the emergency water supply project. By the end of the year, the facility was already built. So it was a very aggressive 6-month timeline, which we made. And the plant officially went
operational in January of 2015.
So now I have truth and disclosure, because in 2014, as this work effort is going, it's also being coordinated with County Public Works. Mark Hutchinson, who is really one of the leading environmental permitting and knowledgeable about environmental regulations, is a deputy director in Public Works who's working with the planning department and working with Cambria to help pull this all together. I was the Public Works director at that point in time, so I wasn't directly involved, because there's another community down the coast by Morro Bay, just south of there, whose name we won't mention because today is all about Cambria, but they ended up taking up a lot of my time. So the Public Works Department, when I was the director, was involved in the 2014 efforts, but I was not directly involved in them.
Okay. So, plants in the ground. We have certain operating assumptions that we were working under in 2015, including a reinjection rate of approximately 456 gallons per minute, which we think will provide about 250 acre feet per year if the plant is run basically continuously for 6 months. So you'd be looking at 24-hour production, 7 days a week for a six-month period. The actual plant production in 2015 was 69 acre feet, and then in 2016 it was 23 acre feet. If you account for the fact that about 60% of the product water that's reinjected into the ground actually makes it into the potable distribution system, that puts us at approximately 55 acre feet that was added to Cambria's potable water supply.
And I think am I on? Yep. We calculated for 2015 that was maybe 10%. Of the water that was supplied for the community.
Right.
In 2015, the percentage would have been lower then.
Yes. Yeah. So 2015, there were some issues that we had to respond to that took the plant offline for several months. By the time 2016 rolls around, you're starting to see that rebound from the drought. So the plant went offline on December 23rd, 2016. 2017, the drought condition was lifted, and we were downgraded to a stage two. And we also saw a very unusual atmospheric event occur in the spring of 2017 that caused some significant stormwater intrusion into one of the components of the emergency water supply project, or sustainable water facility, which is that brine evaporation pond.
So let's take those two as separate. So in 2017 then, you know, we see that the drought's ending, or I can't remember the day that the governor declared it statewide to be over.
I think it was April.
But Cambria then reduced from a stage three to a stage two. You mentioned the stages before. Mm-hmm. Can you run through how do those stages work?
Sure. So a stage one drought is a voluntary conservation program. We ask for a reduction in consumption of about 7% community-wide. Stage 2 drought is a mandatory drought program. That is the first stage where we start imposing restrictions and, you know, issuing those surcharges and fines if you go over your allotment. That is calling for a 15% reduction. And then a stage 3 drought is limiting the water supply for three essential uses, which is sanitation, fire protection, and human consumption. And we ended up, I think, reducing our demand on the potable water supply system by 40% under the stage 3 drought.
Something that Cambria should feel really good about.
Yes.
Also goes back to early recommendations about demand management. So when we look at projects like this, we also recognize the importance of that conservation and demand and management. Mm-hmm. Stage 1, 2, and 3, and then you mentioned the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan, and that's the Urban Water Management Plan in comparison to the Water Master Plan. The Urban Water Management Plan is a document that is essentially a regulatory document that the district has to update every 5 years. And so the last one was 2015. It's going to be updated in 2020. And part of our discussions are recognizing that the triggers on how you go into a 1 or a 2 or a 3, as well as the state has a model of a 6-stage process instead of a 3-stage, We anticipate that that update in 2020 is going to be needing to look at a lot of the stuff like the reliability factors and updating, you know, the consumption, conservation information, looking at whether those particular stages are still appropriate. The board has had some discussion regarding, you know, how do we define our stages. And so that discussion itself is going to be part of the update to the Urban Water Management Plan.
Which I will discuss in more detail in a moment.
In a moment.
The pond.
And, oh, the ponds. Yeah. I wasn't okay. Just trying to, like, defer the discussions of the ponds. You got a couple points. Jim's got a couple points. So
yes, I'll leave most of the technical details to Jim. But the I came in right after the closure plan to decommission the brine pond was approved. So this is my bread and butter. So 2018, 2019, we began pond closure efforts in earnest in the spring of 2018. The impoundment basin was fully dewatered by the spring of 2019, and that brings us to today. We've got the CCSD board directing the revisions to the project description for the coastal development permit application.
I know the other question I forgot on the stages. So you said we went through a 3-2, but we're really not at a 2?
Right. So We are technically under stage 2 drought conditions right now because the board has not taken action to lower that, but that is something that I think will be discussed in the future.
Because but there's no surcharges.
There's no surcharges. There's no penalties associated with it right now. So
it's kind of like a 1.5.
Right. It's, okay. Yeah. The community is still conserving,
yes.
But if you do look at our numbers, it's slowly ticking back up.
Next slide, Jim.
Okay.
And this is Melissa's summary slide.
Yes, basically to recap the important studies. So back to that baseline water supply analysis, that's the one where we first identified that we don't think we have enough water. The projected deficit there is 600 acre feet, so that's what most of those projects after 2000 until about 2013 are looking for. That study also takes into account the MTBE contamination at the Santa Rosa well field. So a lot of those projections are based off of the fact that our water supply was very vulnerable and there was the real threat of losing that entire well field. The Water Master Plan in 2008, again, is looking at those three main projects, the seawater desalination, recycled water, water demand management. The 2013 study is that U.S. Army Corps of Engineers study that looks at the 28 water supply alternatives, screens it down to 4. Those are listed there. The San Simeon Creek Road Brackish Water Project is the concept that eventually gets scaled down to become the EWS because it's able to be sort of packaged in a way that can fit within the district boundaries, which makes it not only more cost-effective, but permitting becomes a lot easier. You're not dealing with right-of-entry permits or anything like that. Then in 2015, the district releases the Urban Water Management Plan. This becomes the water shortage contingency planning becomes something that the state is requiring us to do. So this touches back on Pavo's point that the state is putting together more of a standard approach to drought response and will be recommending a 6-phase program for the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan. We could keep 3 stages, but you'd basically just be putting 1 and 2 of theirs, 3 and 4, 5 and 6 all together. This study also takes a look and reassesses the baselines and targets for our community. So what that means is that we were looking to, by 2020, reduce water consumption down to 117 gallons per customer per day. The actual figures in 2015, and this is partially in response to drought conditions, but it's 69 gallons per capita per day. So that's, we're well below that target already in 2015. This is also the first study that incorporates the emergency water supply system into our future projections, that, you know, the water we would be able to produce from this system is going to help us use all of the allocated water that we have under our licenses. So that kind of just changes how we move forward, how we think about water in the community. And then again, the demand management measures kind of just continues this thread that all the way back to, from 1990, we began looking at conservation as a way of life. So how do we use the water we have wisely?
And one of the sort of, thank you, Melissa. One of the quick questions then is if we have to do a 2020 update to the Urban Water Management Plan, and we're proceeding with a bunch of information for the coastal development permit, you know, what happens if we look at that Urban Water Management Plan and some of the assumption changes, right? So it's always this, there's always these sort of timing complications. I'm going to talk about the CDP process. I kind of throw that out there as a question. We know that ultimately the length of time to that it would take before this is heard through a de novo hearing at Coastal, the update to the Urban Water Management Plan will be well along its way or maybe even done. So it fits into the process. It doesn't create a significant challenge in terms of the process, but it's something that we have to keep in mind. Again, this was Melissa's summary slide, so I think we should all thank her with a round of applause, maybe. Do you want to switch? Are you going to stay up there? Okay, you're going to present from there. So I'm going to cover a little bit of some of these slides, and Jim and I are going to go back and forth a little bit more. So for Cambria itself, not any big surprise, but essentially there's two different watersheds, the San Simeon watershed and the Santa Rosa watershed, and then there's the Pacific Ocean. The fact that after all the analysis and studies since 1990, the conclusions came down to, well, it's either desal or something to do with the reclaimed water, because when you look at Nacimiento or you look at Whale Rock, the engineering analysis or alternatives analysis really needs to look at those. But from a practical standpoint, when we look at how much it costs to put miles of pipelines, you know, those alternatives are pretty easily discounted that Cambria has. And, you know, really for any realistic look into the future is going to be sustained within water resources, either in Cambria or along these watersheds. And the fact that the reclaimed water project ended up being a reclaimed water project through the EWS ended up getting built as one of those things, you know, from an independent type of person who hasn't been involved, is like it was really just one of a limited number of options. There's certainly questions within the community as to whether it should have ever been built or can it be taken down, and maybe that was part of the reference to the referendum earlier, and I'll touch on that a little bit on my final slide. But it's really just, it's two watersheds. We have the numbers there from the water, what was the permits and now the license from the State Water Board, about 1,000 acre feet combined. The actual delivery doesn't even come close to that right now. What's an acre foot? It's 325,000 gallons. And Melissa, I can't remember if it was you or Jim that was going to help me with the quote on how many homes can be in 1 acre foot of water. It was like, in California in general, 1 acre foot, two homes if you're in a large lots and dry climates. On the coast of San Luis Obispo County, and whether it's Los Osos or Morro Bay, Cayucas, or Cambria, we're looking more like 4 or 5 instead of 2 homes can get by on. And then when you're in conservation efforts and everything, it's going to be different as well. Just recapping a little bit again what Melissa had said, that in addition to these license allowances that are issued by the State Water Board, there's also operating criteria. And that operating criteria of how much is being pumped from the wells in which Jim's responsibilities can really mean that we don't even get to pump that much in a given year. Obviously, droughts are going to have an effect on that. But the other question that has kind of been out there that we know about is does the EWS and its production increase those numbers? And the answer is no. These are still the limitations on pumping. The facilities are simply to try to make sure that water is available to get pumped and to bring to the community. Next slide, Jim. So this is the slide that we touched on when Melissa was talking about 2013. And part of the point here is there is a ton of information that the district has. And there's been skepticism about the validity of information that the district has been putting out in the future. And so part of our efforts in moving through a coastal development process is really to be able to look back at those concerns that the community has expressed about past information and was it valid or not, and really go back and look at that data and make sure that we've reviewed it adequately. And having a new team on board with, you know, the intent of really being objective in everything is one of the things that I think we want to make sure that everybody in the community understands is one of our goals. Obviously, the graph shows that water levels can fluctuate. The black line is the average, and then that short one that only goes through August is the current year, which means that well levels right now are still pretty relatively high. And I think, Jim, you mentioned the other day that we still have water flowing. Where's
for our San Simeon production, Palmer Flats starts our dry season, and Palmer Flats is still currently running.
And the importance of Palmer Flats is that once it dries up, then Jim's criteria on how he can operate the wells changes.
Right. We have so the dry season can start as early as April 1st, and it runs through October 31st. So Palmer Flats dictates that dry season for us. Usually stops running mid-May. Last year it ran till mid-July, and we thought that was a banner year. Right now it's still currently flowing, so it's just a little trickle out there. Above ground, correct, yeah. It's just a little trickle right now. It's more of a stagnant pond. I think there's probably more algae than water right there, but it is still flowing. So our dry season has not initiated, which is great, because now if it would stop, we'd only have 60 days or until October 31st. That would be considered our dry season. Our dry season limits us to 155.3 acre feet.
Next slide. So this is just one of those little textbook slides on a water system. And one of the points here is that all those distribution water mains and you know, the vast majority of your water system is underground. And those things that we don't see, we can forget about pretty easily. We know that there's a lot of costs associated with the facilities have been constructed. Throughout California, for quite some time now and for time projected into the future, the estimate is that the cost of water bills is still going to be rising notably higher than the rate of inflation. Couple different factors. One is water supply. The EWS was constructed to help with water supply reliability. Water quality issues have caused water costs to go up. And then all those pipes underneath the ground, there's been a lot of deferred maintenance and a lot of deferred replacements throughout communities. And Jim was talking to me, you're fixing a leak one out of every 3 days?
Yeah, we average about, over the period of a year, it's about every 3 days a leak occurs. Sometimes three in a day.
And the beautiful trees sometimes are the culprits.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The digger pines and the redwoods definitely assist in our leaks.
So, you know, again, a general picture, but we wanted to, you know, make sure to emphasize that when money comes into the picture, costs associated with the facilities that have been recently constructed and what's going to cost in the future is still one component of what the overall water system is costing. And there are other components that are driving costs as well. I think the next slide is yours, Jim. And this is where...
So this is our service area. I'll introduce myself. I'm Jim Green. I was hired last June 2018 to be the chief plant operator for the Sustainable Water Facility. In November of 2018, I took over water system supervisor. So I've been playing those two roles now for almost a year. This is indeed our service area. We do have 4,033 service connections, almost 67 linear miles of pipe. With the 67 linear miles of pipe, we have 368 fire hydrants, four tank sites, and five active potable wells for production.
And Jim being responsible isn't just, you know, the Jim, this is your job. Jim's license is on the line when he's operating these facilities. His responsibilities cannot be overridden by anybody in the district. He's the one whose name is on the Cambria Water System in with the Division of Drinking Water. And it's basically all on his shoulders to make sure that it's operating in accordance with the conditions, it's operating in accordance with health and safety laws. So how many wells do you have in San Simeon Creek?
We have three active wells in San Simeon Creek. Right now, we can only process from two of them, our San Simeon 1. When the creek is flowing, it's 150 feet from a surface water, so it's considered groundwater under direct influence of surface water. So being that they are just groundwater wells, when you have a surface that close to your groundwater wells, you can't pump from it. Our Santa Rosa wells are SWTR, the surface water treatment regulation wells, so they have filtration and disinfection, so that's why we're able to operate all around year with those.
So the distinction there, so even though all those wells are pumping from water underneath the ground, Jim mentioned under the influence of surface water. So when the creek is flowing, then it's your San Simeon well number one?
San Simeon well one.
That's right. Considered to be under the influence, and so the only way he could use it is to build a treatment plant. So any surface waters have to be treated in accordance with surface water treatment regulations, which basically requires a treatment plant. If it's truly groundwater, then basically wellhead treatment with chlorine.
Chlorine disinfection, filtration, your compliance and everything changes also.
The primary is chlorine. You can run into iron and manganese problems and other stuff that you might have to treat at the wellhead as well. And the key there, in the two San Simeon or Santa Rosa Creek wells, those are the ones that my understanding now is that you're more likely to have to turn those off because water levels are decreasing, like not even in a drought year, like your operating criteria.
Correct. We have less acre feet of diversion there.
Okay.
There's 218 per year.
And so the criteria that you have to follow and when you can or when you have to stop pumping on Santa Rosa Creek is different from the wells that you have on San Simeon Creek.
Correct. And I want to correct myself earlier. Our dry season allotment for San Simeon Creeks are 370, but our dry season for Santa Rosa is the 155.3.
Okay.
Acre feet.
Yeah. So if you have these dry season restrictions and yet in the summertime, that's when you end up getting your peak demands.
Right. Our peak demand for the system is our two middle weeks of August.
And so with those cuts, you can still meet your peak demand needs and everything?
We can, but we keep an eye on it. We monitor it daily, our production and our wells. And, of course, we monitor daily the creek flows.
And so that's Jim's one of his huge responsibilities, right? He's got to look at that stuff at a daily basis so that he doesn't fall outside or fall into non-compliance with his permit conditions. But the other thing that the district does is that's part of Melissa's job as the compliance officer is making sure that she's also separately looking at that information. And a lot of public agencies don't have compliance officers, but Cambria is taking those extra steps in order to help, improve upon some of the quality controls that maybe were questionable in prior years. That's the system. Next slide.
Jim, do you want to tell them how far along we are this year? How much water out of our allocated water we've used?
I'm really excited. So far this year, out of both wells, we used almost exactly 41% of our annual diversion. So we're 3/4 of the way through the year, and we've used less than half of our diversion rates. So thank you, guys, really. Thank you.
And this one, so then we move from the overall water system slide into the facilities, the assets are right there on San Simeon Creek. Mm-hmm. That mouse that you have might be able to help with a pointer if you move that around. Yeah, because you were going to start with the flows that come from the wastewater treatment plant are disposed there, and then the well 9P7 that pumps the brackish water.
This is our treated wastewater effluent. This is pond A. So we have ponds A, B, C, and D here. We're just primarily using pond A here. Years ago, this was used as a switch box. When one would fill, we'd divert to another, fill that, divert to another, and they'd percolate. We flow about 500,000 gallons a day of wastewater, treated wastewater, fluent to that percolation pond here. Oh, lost some mouse. 9P7, our raw water source for the SWF, is 451 feet away from that basically injection spot. So that's where we're pulling our raw water that's going to be treated here at our SWF facility.
And so it's that close proximity of wastewater, treated wastewater, important point to make, treated wastewater in accordance with Regional Water Quality Control Board permits. That treated wastewater is percolating down into the ground, and then in close proximity, you're pumping it up out of 9P7 and bringing it into these new advanced water treatment facilities.
Which then heads about 3/4 mile to our reinjection well number one right here, which is just on the four or just before our San Simeon well field, which is San Simeon wellhead number 3, 2, and 1. I'm sorry, 3, 2, and 1 right here.
But
and so you can notice the proximity of San Simeon 1 to the creek right here. It looks farther on this side, but that's less than 150 feet.
And SS1 is the one that you have to shut down when the creek is flowing.
Well, it's not inoperable right now, but we're not operating due to its influence of direct.
And in terms of where you're recharging the treated brackish water, that's still downstream of your well field.
Correct, yes.
And in a later slide, we have an illustration that kind of shows how water, subsurface water, then moves around, mounds up, or declines.
You know, Pavel, while we're showing flows and direction, this is our mitigation line that flows to the lagoon here, this other yellow line running off here. And then, of course, this was our RO reject or our brine discharge that was going to the pond, which is obviously being decommissioned.
And so this is the time where you were going to talk to us about the status of those closure efforts, and apparently there's a December hearing with the regional board to
We were unable to make this September's hearing. It was just there's so much on the regional water quality's plate right now that we were unable. There's a hearing September 19th and 20th that we were trying to get on the addendum to. We're not unable to make that. So December 5th, we'll have a formal closing. But we've actually received paperwork, and we have had closing, so there's no permit or bonding necessary because we've dewatered the pond, solid removal, and actually done a pressure spray of all. It's a 9-million-gallon holding facility, 27-acre-foot, that has been completely cleaned and has been walked by our regional inspector and several others. And we got a high five, kudos, pat on the back for doing such a great job on cleanup. So
we didn't get into any details on why the cease and desist order was issued and why it needed to be shut down, and I don't think we really need to talk about that today. But the point is, in terms of at that cease and desist order and all the boxes that need to be checked and working with the regional board staff and checking all of those boxes, they're all checked, and it's just a matter of going to the regional board so the regional board can say officially that it's closed?
Correct, yes.
So you've done your job.
So far.
Okay. Good job, Jim. I actually think that deserves itself a little round of applause. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you have the other sort of little yellow line that goes down to Van Gorn Creek, and that's the one that will put about 100 gallons per minute of treated water, clean water, into the creek and the lagoon.
So the mitigation water is actually from 9P7 raw water, which goes through a strainer initially and then through our membrane filtration.
Okay.
From there, before going through the reverse osmosis units, just that membrane treated water is the lagoon water.
Okay. So it comes off as a side stream. It doesn't go through the whole treatment process. No. It goes through like step A.
Correct.
And then after going through step A, then it's good to put into the creek.
Right.
And the lagoon.
Which is not chlorinated.
Oh, well, that's the point, right?
Right.
Okay. Because your subsequent steps in the treatment process end up doing disinfection that adds chemicals, and so...
There's several points of disinfection with the advanced water treatment plant, but that would be after that.
There's other projects around that have highly treated water, and then before they can put it back into the environment, they have to dechlorinate it. So essentially, by taking it off as a side stream earlier, You reduce the treatment, and then you reduce having to undo the treatment. Yeah. Any other points on that one, Jim? I think you've covered it.
Yeah. Yep. Fast forward to...
So this slide is actually comes out of the SEIR, and we're just going to cover it really briefly here. What it does is it shows that historically that percolation pond water that came from the wastewater treatment plant, the little box on the left, you know, from the wastewater treatment plant, which is located not in this vicinity, but it's...
No, it's off of Windsor, Heath
off
Lane.
Of Windsor, yeah.
North end of town.
And that's being operated by John Alchin. And shout out to John Alchin because it's part of the implementation of the EWS. And they also made modifications at the wastewater treatment plant, which have helped to actually improve the water quality within San Simeon Creek. And during the Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting a couple months ago, where the updates to the waste discharge permits and waste discharge requirements were getting approved, the regional board members made sure to emphasize the point that they appreciate the work that was being done in Cambria to help improve the water quality in San Simeon Creek. And, you know, again, a lot of that work was being done at the wastewater treatment plant. And shout out to John for his efforts there. Next slide. And so we saw the site plan, if you will, the site of the assets and the resources that Jim had described. And this is then the illustration in the EIR itself. I don't know any additional highlights you want to hit on there, Jim. I've got to get back to my order of my notes.
Right, just that it's a treated wastewater, which I think if John Alchin would here would point out that the actual wastewater, treated wastewater that he's perking into the pond is actually a better quality than the brackish water that exists. So I think an old operator line is the solution to pollution is dilution, and I think that's kind of what we're doing here.
One of the questions that comes up on the biological resources, and again, I think one of the individuals in the during public comment briefly spoke to it, but the pumping out of 9P7, how does that affect groundwater levels? Because you are drawing from a source that you're not normally drawing from. And then how does it affect water levels? How does it affect the riparian habitat in this vicinity? And part of the SEI refers to what's called an adaptive management plan, because no matter how much we might be able to try to do our best efforts at predicting what's going to happen with nature as we're making changes and everything, even budgets are only estimates, right? They're always wrong. In situations like this, scientists and everybody will do their best effort, and groundwater, what was the word you were using earlier, Melissa? Geohydrologists will do their best job too. But an adaptive management plan means actually physically observing what's going on so that changes can be made if something unpredictable is coming up. And so this relationship between 9P7, certainly part of the environmental mitigation is to then to provide, you know, clean water back to the creek and lagoon in order to offset anything that might happen there and provide those environmental benefits. But then in terms of going back into the recharge of the injection well, sort of the second to right versus the extraction wells, then Jim's challenges are there is there's a limitation to how fast that recharged water can actually get over to the well fields. And the requirement is minimum of?
It's a 60-day residence time before it can reach San Simeon Well 3.
And so a lot of people might understand that there was an analysis and then there's a reanalysis that was done subsequently.
Right. The initial 460 gallons a minute of flow reached San Simeon Well 3 in 58 days, which that's why we reduced the flow to 400 gallons a minute.
And then even that type of data can change depending on if creek flows are higher or lower or what's happening with overall water levels in the creek and in the subsurface flows as well. Okay, next slide. This was, you're going to hit on, so that at the advanced water treatment facilities, which really are, you know, the sort of state-of-the-art technology, highly regulated facilities, it incorporates why does it have a three-step process?
Well, so basically it starts off with membrane filtration. The membrane filtration system provides pretreatment for the reverse osmosis system. The membrane filtration system is a fully automated flow control for backwashing, daily maintenance cleans, and periodic clean-in-place features. Even though we could run the plant 24 hours a day, 2 hours out of that day would be a clean-in-place feature, which cleans each train or each filter of that. The reverse osmosis system here, the second, these are again, just kind of illustrations, but removes a wide array of dissolved constituents of suspended solids. It also removes complex organic constituents such as taste and odor-causing compounds. Reverse osmosis is generally the best available treatment technology for reducing total dissolved solids and other constituents of emerging concern in wastewater effluent intended for indirect potable reuse.
And it's in the RO system that we capture the salts as well?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, so microfiltration is you know, we kind of know what we do with filtering, cheesecloths or whatever. These are just catching the really small stuff. And then, like, salts or other things that, I'm not sure if salt actually dissolves in water, but
it's a suspended solid.
So those more complex things, especially, you know, we all know salt, taking salt out of water is hard. That's the RO. And then the advanced oxidation process is...
That's more for disinfection. That's its final disinfection project. We use hydrogen peroxide before the UV, and that's the best available technology that is available today.
And so that disinfection is, the analogy on a wellhead is the chlorine that you're putting in.
Correct.
Because chlorine is disinfection for a wellhead. Right. And then when we get into treated brackish water, wastewater, then we're going to a much higher level of disinfection.
That's what's really zapping that final bacteria.
Good. Next slide. So we're getting pretty close here to the final slides and then a couple summary slides. What this illustration does is it attempts to show what's happening in groundwater levels, subsurface creek levels, as the facilities are being operated. So maybe bring me down to 9P7.
Right,
and
here,
the circles that we see here is we see the water levels are being drawn down at 9P7 and then up to where you're reinjecting the water.
Right here.
And what's that dashed line that we call that? That's the hydraulic barrier.
The hydraulic divide.
Divide. And when it gets recharged, some of that water then flows toward the well field, and some of it then flows downstream.
Right.
So only, you know, what?
60%
is the estimate of what's being recovered in the well field.
Going this way.
And that is the stuff that's going downstream is really important because that helps to create the barrier from the wastewater that's being reinjected from migrating up toward the well field. That type of hydraulic mounding of the water at the reinjection site helps to do two things. One is supply water to the drinking water wells, and then second, to help prevent wastewater that's in the brackish water area from migrating up toward the drinking water wells. And those are analogous, though, even in a normal year, to criteria that you have to watch in your well levels to make sure that you don't have that wastewater moving up toward
Correct, don't lower it to the point where that hydraulic divide would then take on that brackish water to the side.
And what's going on here, we anticipate to be one of the most significant issues in terms of moving forward with the coastal development permit.
This is a good reference, too, to show that 60-day residence time from where the reinjection well is to SS3.
Next slide. Oh, and then you've got a couple of slides coming up that simply zooms in on the advanced water treatment plan and where these different units are.
9P7 would be up here, about 250 feet, which comes in first to the microfiltration unit. two dedicated pumps, one for each reverse osmosis unit.
Well, go ahead and flip slides because I think you show, yeah, then the RO filters are there.
Right here. There's your final disinfection. And then your brine ends up in our tanks, which since the pond closure, we're having hauled off.
So in terms of the brine that you had in the tanks after closing, have you had that hauled off yet?
Yes.
Okay. So not only are
all... No, I'm sorry. That we were allowed to blend. We did samples, and okay. Regional saw the analysis and allowed us to continue to blend. There were 7,000 gallons of wash water, effectively, after cleaning the pond that was left. The constituents were low enough that we continued the blending operations that we had been doing for the prior 13 months.
Blending.
So we take that treated wastewater effluent, which is about 500,000 gallons a day, and we blend about 7,000 gallons of that brine with that. That's the ratio. So it's about 7,000 to 20,000 gallons, depending on the concentration of that brine.
What you're describing is the net effect of what happened when the pond was etched out.
Right.
Correct. Well, when you cleaned the pond, though, you ended up having to remove and truck out a bunch of materials.
No, we blended everything.
Well, but you had solid matters.
We did. There. Yeah, okay. We did have to haul off solid. We took 60 tons?
54
ton of solids were hauled off to landfill. And that was all analyzed and samples. And
so what's remaining is of a quality that when you blend it with the treated wastewater can be discharged at the percolation ponds and meet all of the regional boards. Regulatory requirements.
Absolutely.
So is that possible in the
We'd love to have that available.
We're going to, good question to.
It's a great question. We'd love to have that. But yes,
so those
sorry.
Blue tanks are gone, but we're replacing those. So that is still going to be the method of storing and hauling off brine will be via tanks.
Because these were rented and then rental costs are relatively expensive, so right. The cost-saving measure is to get rid of the rentals and buy some other tanks.
One thing I wanted to note while this is up here, your microfiltration, two dedicated pumps, one goes to RO1, one goes to RO2, and this third RO is to take the discharge from those two, and that's what reduces that to, or basically the reduction rate to 92%. This last RO is just treating that brine from the prior two.
And what you're saying is that the RO process is kind of a two-step process.
Correct.
In order to maximize how
right.
much good water
right.
Is delivered to the community.
And this is basically a half a decade old, and that's still the best industry, the yeah. best available technology in the industry is 92% reduction.
Yeah. Next slide. I think I've got a couple of wrap-up slides.
You do.
So the next steps in terms of this coastal development process that we're talking about is that the District Board of Directors at some point in time, near future, hopefully, will be approving a final project description in order to move forward with the county efforts. Over 2 years ago, July of 2017, the board certified the Supplemental Environmental Impact Report, and attached to that that resolution was a 50-plus document associated with environmental findings. But it stopped right there. And so that's really where we're picking up and having to reevaluate what the resolution was that was adopted by the board. I mentioned previously that the project description in the chapter of the SEIR is very extensive. That chapter itself is in excess of 70 pages, I know. I can't remember what the... But those are actions that the board has already taken. They've certified the SEIR. They've adopted by the adoption of a resolution that included an attachment of a lot of environmental findings, and really it's going to be revisiting that and making a determination of is that what is appropriate in moving forward. One of the components of a project description are the objectives of the project, and so if we look at the project description in the SEIR. Part of the board's deliberations are going to be going through those different objectives. And do we think that all of those objectives or only some of those objectives are realistic in terms of moving forward? But once the board of directors takes action, then it goes to the county, and it's pretty much a two-step process. First, the County Planning Commission is going to have to make a determination on the coastal development permit. They also consider the EIR. They consider it from a slightly different perspective because they have a different jurisdiction. They have to look at it from the local coastal plan standpoint, and I don't know all the measures that they do, but that's part of the coordination coming up. But the Planning Commission has to consider it and take action. And then at that point in time, it becomes an appeals process. And I don't think anybody thinks that it's going to stop, that the appeal would go to the Board of Supervisors, and then the Board of Supervisors considers the coastal development permit. From there, we can anticipate it would then go on to the bottom roll, which is a two-step process with the California Coastal Commission. The first step is where the commission considers, do they think that there's any substantial issues here? And in terms of substantial issues, that has to do with their responsibility sources. Really impossible to envision that the Coastal Commission is going to find that there's no substantial issues. And that hearing itself, though, everybody, you know, it's good to note, we don't have general open public comment. It's very limited comment for the Coastal Commission, if they even want to hear comment, because they can say there's substantial issues. It's kind of an interesting motion. The motion maker often will say, I move that there are no substantial issues, and I urge you to vote no. So normally, you know, when people make a motion, they want people to vote in favor of it, but it's just a little bit different here. The idea is extremely limited comment. It's based on, you know, really does the commission think that there are substantial issues? When we look at coastal resources and what we call environmentally sensitive habitat area, you know, I'm going to go way out on a limb and say the Coastal Commission is going to find a substantial issue. And then the next step and the final step is really the de novo hearing. And the de novo hearing concept is an important one because sometimes projects or applications get appealed on specific points. But at a de novo hearing, the Coastal Commission essentially can open it up to all issues of consideration. And to do that de novo hearing then is where there ends up being a lot of work with Coastal Commission staff between the substantial issues hearing and the de novo hearing. You know, from a really sort of basic timeline standpoint, there's no way there's going to be a de novo hearing before 2021. It just isn't, you know, that's the type of schedule. And if we're plugging around really effectively, then we'll have a de novo hearing in 2021. But part of that is going to how much work, you know, is going to be important with the community prior to even finalizing the project description and going to the planning, to the county. Then it's not uncommon for the Planning Commission itself to try to really hear from coastal staff and others to make sure that their deliberations help to ensure that the final deliberations with the Coastal Commission are as efficient as possible. You know, so the discussions with coastal staff doesn't start after a substantial issues hearing. In fact, it started a long time ago, and it will be ongoing throughout the process. But the more that we can be that we can do at the community before the board's hearings, the better off we're going to be through the entire process. There's also an interesting note with respect to the Coastal Commission itself, is because with the environmental impact reports, a lot of people understand that, you know, you have a point, you have the ability to challenge them, you know, in court. One of the benefits of the coastal process is that the Coastal Commission has what's called an equivalency, CEQA equivalency. So if they're finding through their through that final de novo hearing that something needs to be modified somewhat, they have the ability then to also work with the community and work with the district to make sure that the proper environmental findings are there. And if the Coastal Commission then says, look, we can make the environmental findings so that it doesn't have to go back to the community and redo the SEIR and everything. So that CEQA equivalency at the Coastal Commission is something that's really been structured in there in order to help with, you know, the efficiency of government. Because you could imagine if you go through this five-step process and then all of a sudden have to start it over again, I mean, we get frustrated with processes as they are. But that's an important aspect of coastal. Next slide. And this is the final slide for us. And David, we're almost right smack at an hour and a half right now. Couple of comments, you know, so when we talk about SERs and projects and stuff, it's very much about project descriptions, environmental impacts, environmental mitigation, and those issues. But that's not what it's all about. You know, fiscal considerations and schedule considerations, board priorities. I've been working with your board since essentially the beginning of the calendar year, participated in some of the goal setting processes, worked with Pam Duffield, who's the finance director, and accountability, transparency, committee work are all extremely high values right now for the district. And from what I've been hearing at the hearings, it's because of the need to make sure to reestablish credibility, to really make sure to work with the community and moving forward. That's the commitment that your board has made during these meetings, and it's the direction that we who are working on these efforts have been given. The committee work is not just the R&I resource and infrastructure, but also the finance committee. In order to support board priorities this spring and leading up to the budget, a lot of work was done. I worked with Pam in looking at the Bartow-Wells rate analysis, because that's the analysis that led to the rate increases in 2018 that captures costs, the cost of debt to repay the project, operations. The assumption is that the facilities would operate 2 months out of the year. Those were all evaluated with the budgets. Pam's going through audits right now, and she's really got a heavy workload because she's still working on the June 30, 2018 audit. And so as soon as she gets done with that audit, then she gets to start working on the June 30, 2019 audit. But part of the work that I did with her was to set up an evaluation so that we, the district, can effectively track what were the assumptions in the Bartow-Wells analysis in terms of the cost of these facilities, what were those assumptions versus what is the board adopting in budgets, and then audits ultimately come into, well, what did actual costs? So that's all set up already for the Cambria so that the accountability side can be tracked on a year-by-year basis as to how much it's really costing and how much is it costing in comparison to estimates and in comparison to what everybody was told when the rate increases were adopted. So the board has been really adamant about making sure that that accountability effort is followed through on. In terms of evaluating the dollars, it's been approximately $13 million in these facilities cost to date. That doesn't include, you know, the studies that go back to 1990 and everything. That's really those costs that are pertain to the development of the EWS. I've been using EWS. Jim used SWF a little bit. We know that that can kind of be a little bit of a hot point. I use EWS because I'm focusing on what was built. The SWF to me is what's being proposed. That's what's being proposed in the SEIR. And how that's actually going to shape out is going to be part of the board's future deliberations. But EWS was what was built because that was the emergency permit. SWF has a whole bunch of stuff associated with that that are going to be part of the discussions moving forward. And so our next step is really to develop a schedule of work for the board's October meeting, where with all of these complexities, and Melissa's been doing a great job of digging into some of those research, and she'll send me different documents so that I can, you know, start reading it as well. But that schedule of work, what's the logic of which issues do we need to look at first? What's the sequencing? What issues do we need to look at second? What issues end up becoming more of a priority and more important in the mind of the community, and which issues are maybe important but they're just not as important? How does the board want to approach it in terms of tackling the big issues first, or how do we want to do it? And what do we think the time requirement is going to be in order to address the various issues so that the board can adopt some final actions and we can move forward with the County of San Luis Obispo. And with that, I think it's time to turn it over back to President Pearson.
All right, thank you very much. Great presentation. Not doing the right thing again. All right, let's move to questions and answers here. Hopefully we have enough answers. We certainly have enough questions. Casey Nugent asks, has there been a Kennedy jinx type analysis done in more recent times with droughts getting more extreme and longer in California with or without including the wait list?
Am I on? Okay, there we go. So no, there hasn't been as thorough a report since that baseline analysis. Drought contingency planning is a way of life now, so we do factor that in. That's updated every 5 years in our urban water management plan. But I think as part of a future water master plan update, we would be looking into that kind of deep analysis again.
Good. Thank you. Dr. Bettenhausen asks, what is the CCSD's goal for residential gallons per citizen per day usage? Did I get that right? Oh, capita. Okay. and for total usage outside of indoor. So.
Right. So that's actually going to be regulated. The state of California passed some regulation recently that is going to require urban water suppliers to enforce an aggregate of 50, I think it starts at 55 gallons per capita daily for indoor water use. That's the target. And then it goes down to 50 gallons per capita daily by the year 2030. They have not set the outdoor objectives yet. That's something that they're continuing to look at, and the state is actually going to be providing everybody with some really detailed analysis as far as the topographical layout of all of the entire state. They're doing aerial studies, and they're going to be giving us data about our irrigable landscape, and you know they're involving all of the agencies in coming up with those targets. So. Since we identified that we were already at about 69 gallons per capita daily effective 2015, and Cambria's outdoor water use is actually very, very low, so we're almost assuredly meeting that 50 gallons per capita daily target already.
Second question was, what is the conservation program to achieve these goals? I think we have some of that delineated, but when we do the new urban water master plan, we're definitely going to have to look at that and update that. So that will be part of that process, and we will make sure we have ongoing forums. Either the R&I committee or someone is going to have ongoing hearings on how we can get there. Does the adaptive management plan take these goals into account? And I would guess that the answer is yes, but I don't know.
There's an indirect relationship there, certainly, because the adaptive management plan and looking at how biological resources or riparian resources are being affected is going to have a relationship to how much water is actually being drawn out of the creek. But my general answer to that is that it's an indirect relationship.
Good. Thank you. Ted Key, Army Corps completely missed the non-blue water line smooth wall canyon on Warren Ranch for which separate study was created. Why?
So that was one of the alternatives studied. I think it was number 25 out of the 28 options. And If non-blue line is referring to being outside of the coastal zone, the entire Warren property is within the coastal zone. So that location was definitely...
So non-blue line would generally have referred to it's not on a blue line creek.
Okay.
So is this the question that's addressing a surface reservoir?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, I think that that's part of the details that we're going to be looking at. I'm going to refrain from kind of giving any answers on that right now because I don't want to step in it, I guess. I recognize that that's an important issue, and it's come up with a number of discussions that I've had with individuals. And I, you know, the judgment that I have is that I understand why it didn't move any further, didn't move forward. But that's from a general experience and a general industry knowledge. And so I don't really, you know, want to talk about the specifics of it because I haven't, you know, gotten into the details and reading that level of detail yet. But it is certainly one that we recognize has been part of the discussions, and it's been part of current day discussions, and we will be addressing it more as we move down the path.
Okay, thank you. Again, Ted Key, what are the current MBTE levels at this point? And Amanda had an answer for that one, and it's not currently a monitored issue per the Regional Water Quality Control Board because they closed it years ago after consistent non-detect. I believe what happened was there was the scare of it, but then after they monitored for a number of years, there was non-detect, so they said, well, apparently we didn't have that issue.
Yeah, I have. Okay, so I'm not a scientist or a chemist, but involved in prior MTBEF, you know, I believe it's called a volatile organic compound, VOC. And the volatile word has a significant meaning, which means that it wants to act and it wants to dissipate. So the MTBE problems that we are having, Morro Bay had significant problems and had to shut down well fields. I know San Luis had some problems with it. But the fact that they went in there, they pumped, they treated it, they allowed those. But because it's volatile, you would expect then the compound presence to decrease over time, and I really haven't heard of a significant MTBE problem for quite some time. I think they've all, wells are sealed.
All right. One last question from Mr. Key. Acre foot of water equals 356,000 gallons. You say four houses per year. Thus, each home consumes 10 units per month. Correct. We would like to do the math and put that out of the website for you. Okay?
Yeah, and I was speaking sort of generically for coastal communities versus inland communities that have hotter climates and maybe larger lots. Melissa talked about the standards that are being established by the state, 55 gallons per day, indoor 50 when we get into drought situations. But in terms of this, they're struggling with the standards for outdoor consumption because it varies all over the state. And what she really spoke to is that the state is trying to develop the criteria then and which local agencies will set our outdoor standards. We submit our reports to the state. They look at the work that we've done and determine whether or not they agree with it or not.
Okay. Marjorie Zolowitz, Jim, you stated that we used only 41% of our water allocation for the year 9 months in. Does our allocation vary based on rainfall during the rainy season?
No, it does not. That's our standard annual diversion.
And is our annual use remaining relatively steady to our allocation? So in other words, we're using about 500 and something for the last 5 years acre feet.
Correct, yeah.
So our conservation is holding steady pretty good.
Yeah, our consumption and our, lack for a better term, our use of it has remained consistent for the last 5 years that we've looked at. So, yeah.
Okay.
So if I could just interject, though, because the question asked, you know, what's your entitlement, what's your license for? That doesn't change. Doesn't change based on how much it rains. But the operating criteria that Jim has to follow and how he can actually pump, that does change dependent on rainfall.
Yeah, because it affects the amount of water flowing through the creek, basically. Okay.
And your well levels.
Ms. Zolowitz, again, does our water quality vary from year to year, depending upon rainfall amount, i.e., does the mineral content change from year to year?
It does. In drought years, the hardness increases a little bit, but our hardness is actually relatively low. On a hardness scale of like 200 to 750, we're in the mid-300s, and that stays pretty consistent. We'll be low 300s, and the hardness scale up to maybe 375 that I've seen for the last decade on the research that I've done.
And do you ever see challenges in meeting the potable drinking water requirements?
No, not at this time, no. Not with those figures.
Dr. Bettenhausen again, does the RO remove all pollutants in sewage effluent before reinjecting upstream, i.e. prescription drugs flushed down toilets in Cambria?
Well, yeah, that would be a no because of the nature of the question, right? I think the question embedded pharmaceuticals in there?
Yes.
Okay, so pharmaceuticals are one of the contaminants of emerging concern. The idea is that and it's not just the RO, it's also the microfiltration and the advanced oxidation. Those three components to that advanced water treatment plant are all required in order to meet the regulatory requirements. Now, that question about pharmaceuticals is often outside of the regulatory requirements, and there's a lot of people who are evaluating that in order to determine what do we need to be concerned about with respect to pharmaceuticals. I just became a LinkedIn friend with an individual who just did her PhD thesis in, like, Wisconsin or someplace like that. Because her PhD thesis has to do with how might we remove estrogenic compounds within the wastewater streams. And so there's a lot of scientists who are looking at it. Right now, from a regulatory standpoint, the treatment process meets all of the regulatory requirements and the future of, you know, how might treatment requirements change might also be dependent on how we could actually treat some of this stuff. Part of the message is, you know, if you have excess pills, you don't flush them down the toilet. You put them in the trash can. You make sure that they get to the landfill and not into our water supplies. But the point here is that all of the requirements that
actually
we have,
there's a recycle path for those.
I stand corrected.
You should do,
but don't put them in the water supply.
Don't put them in the water supply.
Yeah.
Well, constituents of emergency concern have been added to our analysis. Should we run the plant also? So that will be looked at in the future. Should we run?
All right. I don't know if everybody heard that one. Say that one again, Jim.
Constituents of emerging concern have been added to our analysis for our sampling program. So going forward with processing from that plant, that will be something that we isolate and look at, too. That will be
And that's a good example of how the local agencies work with our state agencies, because there's an issue that comes up publicly, and we're saying, hey, should we be concerned about this, or what are we going to do about it? Well, the state doesn't have all that data. You know, it's Jim and the operators who have the data. So, you know, he'll provide data even before they set any sort of regulatory requirements, and it's that interactive process of trying to make sure that all the agencies are addressing, you know, public health and safety.
Okay. Ms. Jacobs is asking, could we add a storm diversion to the well 1 during rainfall until it fills the well to decrease the whole process cycle of the EWS?
So probably not exactly how she's described it. You don't really want to directly feed wells because, as Jim had mentioned, that triggers in the surface water treatment requirements. But doing recharge projects and those things that help maintain overall well levels is a good idea. We didn't touch on it in the PowerPoint, and maybe it was sort of something I should have touched on, but with the closure of the pond, when I started getting involved with the district, it begged the question of whether or not it might be converted to a stormwater capture system. The state is supporting, you know, we all want to be able to capture stormwater and make sure that it provides environmental benefits. So one of the local engineering firms did a cost analysis, and, you know, there's some benefits, but the problem is it would be very expensive. And so those types of issues are certainly on the table, but they're not directly part of the project description at this point in time.
All right. Casey Nugent, what is the ratio of waste to good product from the plant? And she has a follow-up that's kind of, how many truckloads does it take to get rid of the waste, quote-unquote? So I guess they're looking for how much brine waste we produce.
Right, so if the EWS would produce 250 acre-foot, it would also produce 6.5 million gallons of brine, which is why the evaporation pond was sized the way it was.
Okay, and then how do we get rid of that brine?
Well, we'd like to blend it eventually. But
the permitted, though, is the trucking option.
Permitted is the trucking option.
Do we know how many truck trips that would be on that, what, 6.5 million?
6,000 gallons per truck, so...
A lot?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's keep that one, and let's answer that on the website, and we can get the
right,
exact
we need to do some finite math on that.
Okay, good. No conjecture here. We want to get the facts out. Ted Key basically is asking, what does the district do with the waste from the advanced water treatment plant? So the same kind of thing.
Where can you bring it? Where do you truck it, Jim? South County Sanitation District?
Correct. Yes, yeah.
Kettleman City?
South County Sanitation is where we have a permit with right now.
Yeah. So it's trucked down to South County and dumped there. Yes.
Well, they treat it.
Which we're permitted to do. Yeah. Mr. Lyons, why can't we dilute brine with seawater and release it to the ocean as is done in Carlsbad, the Sal plant?
I guess the quick answer is we don't have regulatory approval to do it. With the decommissioning and the closure of the evaporation pond, it really sort of opens up and begs a bunch of different questions. And I know that some of those have been touched on in the past. And, you know, whether those alternatives are looked at again in the short term or whether they're looked on down the road is going to be part of the, you know, board's discussions in the future.
Okay, thank you. Jim Webb, water is subject to gravity. It flows downhill reliably. The injection well is below the well field at San Simeon. How does this water flow uphill to the well field?
You want that one or you want me to do it? Well, it's because we mound it. So as you're re-injecting, your water level starts going up, and it gets up in a high enough elevation that it appears to go uphill, but it's still really going downhill.
So, well, there's also this great big pump that's sucking the water out.
Well, out of the...
the mound.
Right. So it's really all about what's the groundwater levels that we don't see, because we know the topography is going downstream, but the groundwater levels are doing something different.
Ted Key again, the effluent pond, the brine pond, has been shut down. How long to return it to previous condition? I can answer that one. We had a study done by Canon, which is we're still looking at, but any reclaim or redoing of that, okay, what we'd like to do is going to cost a lot of money. Putting it back the way it was is still going to cost $1 million. And guess what? We don't have it. So for now, we're going to leave it there until we can figure out exactly where we can come up with the money, get a grant or something to hopefully do the stormwater capture that Paavo was talking about. That would be the ideal. Okay. Casey Nugent again, since the original plan included the use of the brine pond, what has changed that could allow for the blending as a solution? I think we've already answered that one. We'd have to get regulatory approval to blend it back again. Amanda asked a question. Does the district treat water from our five potable wells before being distributed, i.e. that's not run through the AWTP? In other words, when we take it out of the wells, do we treat that water? And how do we treat that?
Yes, your Santa Rosa wells are surface water treatment plants, so they go through a filtration process and disinfection. Your groundwater wells at the San Simeon are just disinfected and sent directly into your injected into your distribution lines.
Okay. Don, where does the non-potable water come from to satisfy the Warren settlement?
Approximately 9P7. It's a separate wellhead, but it's 20 feet away from 9P7, so that's that source water for Warren's well.
Okay. Did that answer your question? Yes. Mr. Kuhn, is all the wastewater pumped to San Simeon? From our wastewater treatment plant, all of the wastewater treated water is pumped to percolation ponds at San Simeon. It doesn't go anywhere else. Okay, that's the only place it goes. Is the 4,600 approximate customer objective in the SEIR subject to revision by the Board of Directors of CCSD as part of the CDP process? We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, that's one of the big questions, and it's not just what the board's actions might be, it's also what the county or coastal commission's actions might be. But that's certainly, you know, one of the top three questions that's, I think, going to be addressed in the future.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Is it, I'm going to correct. We said 9P7 for the Warren water. It's 9P4. 9P4 and 9P7 sit next to each other. So 9P4 is a non-potable well that brings the Warren Ranch their non-potable water. 9P7 is the extraction well for the AWTP.
Okay. Thank you. Casey Nugent again, do you have data about costs and efficiencies of operations during different conditions such as soil dryness, aquifer levels? This would help to determine when it should be run most efficiently.
Maybe you can repeat that one.
Do you have data about costs and efficiencies of operation during different conditions such as soil dryness, aquifer levels, etc.?
That's kind of one of the other big questions. You know, I'd say there's like three of them out there. There's more than that. But that's the big question on how might the facilities be operated in the future. And so I turned to Jim and Melissa a while ago, and I keep asking them. I go, well, if you've got this facility and it's cleaning up this brackish water, why not use it all the time? You know, of course, I'm being a little bit as if that was the only issue, right? I mean, there's a lot of other issues. What are the constraints? You know, money. It costs a lot to operate it. Jim identified that at SS1 and SS2 and SS3, he's got operating constraints depending on if the creek is flowing or if it's not and what water is being reclaimed. There's a lot of details behind that particular question. And so, again, we don't want to, you know, say this is how it should happen or anything. But those are the types of things that we've been talking about and, again, are going to be coming up in future discussion. Because, to me, you've constructed an asset. The question is, how is that asset going to be best utilized? And it's water supply reliability issues. It's environmental stewardess issues. There's the objectives that are specific to the community of Cambria itself. And then you've got physical issues. And how can Jim actually operate this thing depending on soil conditions and those physical things? So that is one of the big issues that we'll have to be exploring in greater detail.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Key again, what is the kilowatt per hour consumption of the EWS? You don't know that off the top of your head, do you?
We can post that to the website.
We'll post that one. Thank you. Ms. Jacobs, the $1 million maintenance fee is overwhelming for this little town. If build-out increases, the operational costs soar. For fans, trucks, disposal waste, and personnel filters, water storage off roofs is cheaper, correct? I think the The 2015-2018 study basically took into account all the costs that were projected on the plant. I don't think it's going to increase above what we've already projected in the Prop 218 rates.
We're going to have to work on that question because there's sort of questions embedded in that question.
And water storage off roofs, that's fine for, that's non-potable water then. You can't drink that or use it for other things. That's gray water. If you want to do that at your home, that's a great conservation effort, so that's wonderful. But we can't do that. The CCSD can't do that. What data were used to reach the conclusion in the PowerPoint and the agenda that the cost of the project is $13 million to date? And are the data available to the public? And if so, how?
So Pam Duffield, the finance director, part of it is relying on prior analysis, but that's the current analysis that she has recently given us. And during my last slide, I sort of touched on the issue of audits. So really the truthing of those costs associated with the EWS is what she's doing right now. But that's the analysis that she was able to provide us, again, based on some prior accounting analysis and subject to the audit that's ongoing.
Ted Keith says, cost for this machine from $4 million to $15 million plus, please explain. I don't think we have time to do that today, but we can try to outline what we can give them a more definitive costing of what everything went for.
Yeah, right? I think that's going to be important too, to work with Pam as she goes through the audit and see how the cost differed from what the original estimates were. The $4 million mentioned is approximately equal to the amount of grant money that was obtained. From the very beginning, I think there was the belief that the community was going to have a cost as well. So one of the documents that I read quickly had indicated a $9 million number, and I don't know if that was the original cost estimate, but the $4 million was really the grant money.
Karen Dean asks, does the water produced by the advanced water treatment plant create new water above and beyond our 799 acre feet permitted, or is our limit from the Sam Simeon aquifer the same regardless of whether it's running or not?
The proposed 250 acre feet that you could get out of this facility, it does not change what is allocated to us. In a good year, if we could use all 799 acre feet of the San Simeon aquifer without turning that plan on, we could. In a bad year where we needed to supplement the supply and recharge the aquifer, that 250 acre feet that we're recharging, whatever you're extracting out of the potable wells, that gets counted under that 799. So it doesn't matter the rate of reinjection. It matters what's coming out of those three wells at the San Simeon well field.
Okay. Alan Dean, how much has Cambrian's population changed since the Kennedy-Jenks study? So I think our population has basically stayed the same since then, right? It's about 6,000
people. Right, it went up a little bit, and then around 2000 we actually dipped. It's been stable for the last 15 years or so. They're obviously approaching the next census, but that's something I can also post on the website.
Okay, very good. That's it for the questions. Thank you. How do I get this to go back one? Good. All right. So concluding remarks are basically thank you all for coming. We covered a lot of information. I'm now going to ask the board if they have any comments or questions that they would like to bring up at this point. Just raise your hand if you do so, and I'll recognize members of the board. No. Yes. Vice President Farmer. You can use that one.
Marika, thank you. The former president had to assist the current vice president in turning on his microphone. Just want to interject that there. Cool. So Ted Key just handed a question to us. Does the water facility do anything for firefighting?
Well, indirectly by making sure there's an adequate supply of water to get into the tanks.
Okay.
Okay. Hope you feel that answer was sufficient, Mr. Key. I think the first comment that I'd like to make is our obligation as humanity to the natural environment that we live in. And first and foremost, especially the environmentally sensitive habitat area where this plant is located. As I say, our first obligation is to make sure that enough water exists for the, you know, for the frogs, for the fish, and the other creatures that live there, and make sure that they're able to live in a healthy environment that provides for them. Also, what hasn't been addressed in this presentation is the cost of this facility, other than a ballpark figure of $13 million. So I just wanted to let folks know that with regard to the agreement that we made with the bank that loaned us the money for this, the bank owns this facility. We don't own it. We're buying it back from the bank, as we know. We pay $55,000 a month. This is a 20-year contract. You, the community, the ratepayers of Cambria, are paying $55,000 a month. You've been paying this for the past 5 years. You will be paying this amount until August of 2034 for this facility. In the last three fiscal years, when this plant has not been operating, and mind you, when it did operate for a brief period of time, it only provided 10% of your water. In fiscal year 16 and 17, obviously fiscal year July through the following June, 16 and 17, this community spent $950,000 on this facility. In 17-18, it was $1.4 million. In 18-19, it was $1.3 million. The current fiscal year is going to be roughly $1 million. Mind you, this plant is not operating. It is not providing you any water, but this is what this facility is costing you in one fashion or another. For environmental impact reports, the subsequent environmental impact report, other costs that have taken place as well. So I think it's important for you folks, for folks to understand this project has yet to go before the planning department, has yet to be addressed by the Board of Supervisors, will probably reach the California Coastal Commission somewhere in 2021. So that will be almost 7 years from the time this plant was built and you continue to pay for it before it even gets approval by the various local and state regulatory agencies. It's hard to kind of wrap our head around how much this facility is costing. And you may wonder, well, why did we build this facility? To make sure that we had water during drought, that it would blend wastewater with water from the creek to ultimately provide us with enough water when things got difficult? In 2016, one of the members of the board that was running for re-election sent out a letter, obviously encouraging folks to elect this person. And this person had three different reasons why we should be grateful for having the plant. One was we will always have a sufficient amount of water, that we will have water to fight fire. And the third reason was so that we could build up to 750 houses over the next over 20 years. Now, mind you, this plant was supposedly built for emergency purposes only, yet you had someone running for office who had been instrumental in this plant being built, who said that one of the reasons we should be grateful for the plant, that we could build up to 750 houses over the next over 20 years. So just give that some serious thought as to, would you want that to happen in this community? How do you feel 750 houses during that period of time would impact the quality of life here, would impact the infrastructure? Mind you, I should also say that the amount of money that we've spent on this facility, we have not had enough funds to even begin to address the ongoing neglect that has taken place for years with regard to upgrading infrastructure at water and wastewater. Yet you've had, what, over $4 million just in the past 3 years spent on this facility that isn't operating.
Was that person reelected?
That person was reelected and
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think this is all relevant to this facility and water that we've been discussing here. Okay. So I'll since people seem to be getting a little upset with the direction I'm going here, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Howell.
A couple of things. First of all, thanks to everybody for coming. And to our friends out there who are watching, I kind of wish you had come also, and at least thank you for watching. I do feel that perhaps some of the folks who are not here today, because they probably felt they already knew all the answers, I suggest that perhaps they might have been mistaken about that. And so, while I'm glad that I see everyone here, I also see a lot of empty chairs, and I'm a little concerned about that. One question which I intended to hope to ask or hear an answer, and maybe there is no answer yet, but do we have any idea as to what the costs would be just to maintain the facility in readiness, not the cost for purchasing it or anything, just because it costs us something just to keep it there so we can turn it on. Do we have an idea as to how much money that is? And it would be on an annual basis.
Yeah, I think we do, but I don't have it at the top of my head. Okay. So I think Pam can generate that for us.
No, thanks.
The only response I wanted to provide on that is during the regional board's recent approval to the waste discharge requirements, at the board hearing, they added the condition that making sure that the plant was in a a readiness type of standpoint, being maintained adequately, was also incorporated into the waste discharge requirements. That's an effort then between district staff and regional board staff that has to, be fully vetted and everything. And that, that itself could have some cost implications if there's new requirements imposed by the regional board.
Okay, good. Director Rice, you had...
I'm really glad we had this discussion today, and I'm glad that there are folks here, and I'm glad it's being recorded. I think it's a very important important topic. I think there's what I heard in some of the questions was some underlying assumptions that may not be correct or may not have been decided yet as far as how we go forward on this. I'm going to become a broken record in a way that I think the person that was here as a director a long time ago, Mr. Funky Ballou, did, and I'm just going to continue to repeat, how much is enough? What do we mean by that? What is reliability? When we say 90% reliability, that's 1 year out of 10. Theoretically, it could be 5 years in a row out of 50 or something, but where we have to cut back. Not have sand come out of our taps, cut back so that we do have enough. And enough means different things to different people. I remember when we first had the very strict 50 gallons per person per day indoor use, and we requested people turn off their sprinklers. We had sprinkler days. People told me they didn't use very much water, but they were shocked at how much water they stopped using when they turned off their irrigation system. So I think everybody has a different idea of what is enough. I mean, I don't use very much water. For some people, it means 4 units. For some people, it means 20 units. So I think it's important that we actually have that discussion, and I'm glad the state did something which didn't exist back when we were doing a lot of the decision-making in the early 2000s, which is they said, here's how much per day, per household, per person to expect to use indoors. And we're going to reduce that. Governor Schwarzenegger said 20% by 2020. And so communities are expected to reduce by that much. We've been redefining how to live on the coast in ways that not only protect the precious coastal areas from us, but rather how by living in these places, how we can assure that ongoing ecological vitality without trapping it in amber. We have to maintain the vitality of the environment because we all rely on it. We are part of the environment. Having us not be here to mitigate some of that vitality, we do impact the vitality. The environment impacts how well we live. I don't think that we're on the wrong track here with an asset that we've already built. Did we need it in the first place is not a question that matters at this point because we have it. So we have to figure out how we're going to use it intelligently and economically because it is the most expensive water probably in almost in the state when you're not talking bottled water from the grocery store. And so we don't want to use the advanced water treatment plant very often, but we have to have people working on our other surface treatment plants and people working on our distribution system. And there's been a lot of focus on this project, and I hope that we're able to get it permitted in a way that is consistent with the agencies that are responsible for the resources that we're trying to manage. We just have to be good about our demand management in addition to taking care of the supply for us and for the environment. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Our next steps, I believe, yes. Director Seidel.
Thank you. Thank everyone who showed up today, number one. It takes personal time off of a day during the weekend, and I understand what that commitment is for a lot of people. So the fact that there were folks who were interested enough to be able to show up today and participate and feel that they had something to learn or wanted to glean something from this, I commend you for doing so. There have been a lot of conversations about the vitality of things here, but I want to remind everyone, too, that we have an obligation to the vitality of our community. And by vitality of the community, I mean the idea of being able to attract people to our community who can afford to live here and who we'll have kids that will go to our schools and maintain the vitality of the learning methodologies available to them and the kinds of teachers we can attract. But also to understand the significance of the things other than just the immediate vitality of the ecosystems, what else keeps us safe in terms of fire? And one of the things that keeps us safe in terms of fire is being able to have things be green that don't burn. And the way you get things that are green that don't burn and burn down houses is that you be able to give them enough to be able to grow and stay green. So I would like to be able to think that we have enough foresight to consider that as part of the equation that's going on instead of it just be singular. And I'd like to also ask the community to start thinking in terms of something than the immediate. I think that with the effects of global warming, the rising of sea waters, we need to be concerned about what 10 years is going to be from now, what 20 years is going to be from now, and what that represents. We need to be able to protect our streams. If we have saltwater intrusion to our streams, then, you know, game over, folks. We're not going to be able to react quickly enough to find other methodologies for water to be able to sustain our community. So I would caution folks also to try to balance their immediate thoughts and their passions and their opinions with trying to consider the things that we need to keep in mind for downline. And thank you all for coming.
All right, I don't want to miss anybody now. Are we good? All right, again, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Karen, again, for the cookies. There's a movement, Save Alan's Health, by please taking some of the cookies with you. At our next meeting, next Thursday, we will be discussing our next steps, which is probably going to be referring the project description to the R&I committee, okay? So we'll be talking about that at the next meeting if you'd like to come. Thank you.